So I'm going to talk about the balancing methodology. If that was thought to mean kind of proportionality 101 in fundamental rights, if that was the intention, then I'm going to disappoint, actually, because that wasn't how I read it. What I'm going to talk about is the role that the concept of fair balance between different fundamental rights has come to play within particularly European Union copyright law. And I've chosen that because, one, it's a development of law that I'm very familiar with, but also, secondly, I think we've seen an amazing development in this area where we've got something derived from fundamental rights law, derived from public law, which is coming to serve as... That's fantastic. Do we know where it goes? Is someone else going to have to come through the door to do that? Thank you.
Sorry.
One of these.
Exactly. And here you go.
Fantastic. There we go. Safe. Feels so much safer with PowerPoint. Yes, I know. So we see a development in this area of law where ideas derived from human rights law have come to play a functional role in IP law. And I think that development's really interesting, and that's what I want to talk about. I mean, we as IP lawyers are really happy to talk about balance, aren't we? I mean, I think if you attended an IP lecture without somebody mentioning the concept of balance, at some point it would be a very strange IP lecture in a way. And often we use it simply as a kind of rhetorical issue. But in some instances, the idea of balance acquires a greater degree of significance than that. So I'm no Canadian copyright lawyer, but I understand post-Teberge, post-CCH, that the idea of balance is presented not just as, you know, something we say before we come to a decision, but actually as a more of a governing principle. And I think that's something that we've seen happen in EU copyright law. And I think the reasons for that happening are interesting and are different. And that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the way in which this fair balance model has evolved, and also to talk a little bit about some problems that I foresee with the adoption of that model. And really, this is part of a project, a thing I'm trying to write, which is about revisiting an article that I wrote a few years ago about the use of fair balance in the constitutionalisation of copyright law, and which I now think probably was more than a little intemperate. And probably wrong in part, so I just think it's a more considerate approach to the issue is needed, and that's what I'm trying to do. So, fair balance. So this notion of fair balance, which is a form of proportionality analysis, where you're in a situation where you have two rights that need to be dealt with, which apparently conflict, is there as a ghost in the Metronome Music case, which Martin mentioned previously. That was a case in which the introduction of rental rights was challenged on the basis that it interfered with rental shops' rights to conduct a business. And in that case, in a very loose sense, the court talked about the need to weigh up the right to conduct a business against general principles of European law. So this is pre-charter. And one of those general principles was the need to protect creators. And in a very loose sense, this came out to the conclusion that it was okay for the rental right to exist, which, of course, was very convenient. One imagines that no other consequence would have been possible. But anyway, it was reasoned within a fundamental rights framework. But the real, in a sense, integration deeply into copyright law of this idea of fair balance came with the Information Society Directive. And the source of many references to it have been Recital 31. And you could see that in a recital that's directed at limitations and exceptions, that refers to the need to have a fair balance between competing rights. But this idea of fair balance isn't simply rhetorical in the way in which we talk about balance generally in IP. It comes with history. Fair balance is a term of art in EU law and in human rights law. So when we look at proportionality, as all of you will probably know, the final step, proportionality strictu sensu, is to weigh up the competing balances, the competing interests. In human rights law, fair balance is a term of art in the law of the European Court of Human Rights. So, for example, where there are no explicit exceptions present, so, for example, if a positive obligation is placed upon a state to honour a particular right, then the concept of fair balance is applied by the court to designate the sort of proportionality review that has to take place in determining whether or not that positive obligation has to apply in a particular instance. It's also used in Article 1, Protocol 1, which Martin talked about before, as the standard for assessing interferences. And in those contexts, it comes with a broad margin of appreciation, typically. So there's the idea that where you're weighing interest in this context, then you have a little bit more space to do that. And that's also apparent, so it's also employed as a term in the Strasbourg jurisprudence to designate the situation where you have two conflicting rights that you have to weigh. So typically Article 8 and Article 10 in the media freedom cases. And again, in those circumstances, there's an acknowledgement that this is a difficult exercise and it comes along with a certain amount of discretion. That, however, is not the way in which it's been absorbed necessarily in the Court of Justice's case law, although that was the flavour of metronome music at an early stage. But following the Information Society Directive and Recital 31, we have, of course, seen the use of fair balance in a large number of situations, most notably in relation to remedial measures. So Pro Musicae was mentioned previously, and that really was a kind of breakthrough in the fair balance history, as it were. So there, in that case, as you'll all be familiar with, the court had to decide, well, the court was asked whether there was an obligation or whether it was permitted to make a disclosure order, as has already been mentioned. The court says, no, you don't have to have this for sure in balancing up the enforcement directive and the data protection directive, but if you do, you have to make sure that you do this. Okay, and following Pro Musicae, we've seen a whole series of subsequent cases listed on there. I've simply listed them at this point and not taking you to the specific paragraphs because I know that Christina is going to look at those in greater detail later. But what we see as we move through cases applying Pro Musicae in relation to IP remedies, predominantly these are copyright cases, but COTI, as already mentioned, is a trademark case, is a tightening of regulation. So in Pro Musicae, you get a situation where the court says, well, you don't have to do this, but if you're going to, you do it this way. To a situation, I mean, Scarlet Extended is a little bit different. The court applying the fair balance test says, you cannot require somebody to monitor, or an internet service provider to monitor the traffic going through its servers, because that would violate their right to conduct a business on a fair balance. The court there also takes into account third-party interests. So a balance is a kind of two-way thing, isn't it? You always go under the scales. But in this respect, you've got three interests in Scarlet Extended. You've got the right holders, you've got the ISP itself, and you've got the users. But the concept of balance can take the customers into account because they're thrown into the pan alongside the ISP as well. So their interests in privacy and in expression can be taken into account. But after Scarlet Extended, we really see a kind of tightening of the net, and this was something that kind of Martin noticed really in when he moved and he talked about Coty Germany, because you move gradually towards a situation where the court comes close to saying, in the interests of Article 17, you do have to have some sort of remedial protection for right holders. You know, either you have to have some sort of disclosure order system because of the combination of Article 17 and Article 47, or more recently in McFadden, you know, simply leaving your internet network, your wireless network open, may not honour the fair balance at all. And also, of course, Richard mentioned previously, significant jurisprudence in this jurisdiction, which is largely responsible, which builds on those basis and actually gives detailed rules, or, you know, so the fact that someone has to come to court to represent the interests of the porn viewers whose details are, you know, required by the IP owner. So actually putting flesh onto the bones of this balancing system at a national level has been very important. So fair balance has had importance here, but it's important to realise that it's not just in the area of whether an injunction can be awarded at all. So actually the concept of fair balance has come to have a role in relation to exceptions and limitations as well. And that's not surprising really, because that's what the relevant recital was originally directed at. But as early as Piner, in 2012, I think, the court said in interpreting the quotation exception that we have to look and establish a fair balance between competing rights. If we do that, and the particular question that was being resolved here was the question of whether the quotation right could only apply when the quotation was in something that was itself a work. The court says, well, if we apply the fair balance, it doesn't really matter to the property right holder or to the user in terms of expression. So on that basis, we should allow it to go ahead. A more dramatic use of fundamental rights in a balancing sense in the German Constitutional Court, in the Kraftwerk case, which I've cited at the bottom of the page, in which the traditional and orthodox approach to the concept of free use in German law was adjusted in line with a fair balance to allow sampling of a very small element of a sound recording. And that's done in an explicit balancing methodology. But I would argue that we go beyond that in the Deckmann parody case. More recently, we see an even more entrenched role for fair balance being played. Because what the court says there is, having interpreted the concept of parody, using the dictionary, essentially, and common sense, the court says, but actually, if you have to apply that at national level, then you have to do so in accordance with fair balance as well. So a direct imposition upon the national decision maker to secure a reconciliation of the competing interest in applying it in a specific instance. And that, I'm sure, will be a familiar development to many of you. What I think might be a little bit more surprising is the claim that this idea of fair balance has also come to be used in terms of determining the scope of the exclusive rights in some instances. So clearly, you know, the decision in GS Media that to some extent the meaning of communication to the public, or whether you have committed a communication to the public, depends upon the degree of knowledge or knowledge you should have had of a particular fact. I mean, that's the controversial outcome of GS Media. But actually, in the judgment, it's framed within the fair balance idea. So you can see there, I've taken from paragraph 31, where the court cites this notion that we've seen in Deckman in the remedy cases. It then goes on to say, and the internet is very important for freedom of expression and information. Yeah, we, of course. And it says, on that basis, it will be difficult for people placing links to know exactly where that link is taking them. Therefore, we have to come to this conclusion. And whatever you think of that conclusion, I mean, what's interesting to see here is the framing of that conclusion within this idea of constitutional rights and within the idea of the fair balance. So this is the process that I think is taking place. We're seeing a movement towards fair balance occupying a more fully integrated role within the jurisprudence. And it's happening in situations in which the existing rules either provide little guidance, so you've got a conflict of directives in pro musicae, or you've got this question of whether a link to an unlicensed work can be a communication to the public, and all you've got is the directive to determine that, so you know you just haven't got the tools to determine the answer. Or you have situations in which there's an obstacle to a desirable outcome. So in Deckman, for example, the court wants that provision, Article 5.3k, to function as a full limitation and exception at European level. You know, they're no longer simply umbrellas for states to shelter under. Those have to be workable, fully definable exceptions and limitations. But of course, all Article 5.3k says is states can have exceptions for parody, caricature, or pastiche. On its own, that's unworkable as a limitation or exception because it's just too broad without any limiting tools. What the fair balance concept does is it gives the court a limiting tool in those circumstances. So fundamental rights provide a structure of justification for these outcomes. If that's a I don't know what that school of thought would be, whether it's kind of cynico-functionalist view, but effectively, I mean, that is the outcome that is driven by the use of this concept. And it allows the progressive development of a set of rules. They become ever more detailed. We see that in the remedies cases. And there are real advantages here, because clearly many of the rules at EU level in copyright are particularly undeveloped. You know, there are gaps in the directive scheme. And fundamental rights provide a framework of principled development. You know, this has authority within the union's legal order. And what alternatives do we have for steering courts in these uncharted waters? Well, I suppose we have the idea that right holders should be protected broadly and that that's the fundamental purpose of the directive. But that doesn't help in a case in which you think the defendant ought to prevail. We have a purposive interpretation, but how would that help us in relation to GS Media, for example? You know, there is just no way of reasoning to a sensible conclusion on a purposive approach there. Having this body of rules as a framework, as a map, as a guide is very useful. And it's also important to remember that the judges in the Court of Justice are, of course, generalist judges. They're not IP lawyers at all. They're predominantly public lawyers. So this is a framework with which they're very familiar, and it ensures, theoretically, consistent development with other bodies of rules in EU law. Many scholars have welcomed this development. Christoph Geiger is perhaps the most obvious advocate of constitutionalisation of this sort. And I hope I haven't perjured anybody in the room to suggest that we have some degree of welcome also from a number of other scholars who recognise the value of principles of this nature in terms of legal development. But what I want to do in the last few minutes that are available to me, I hope, is just to point up, just to flag up some potential difficulties that we might encounter as well. So firstly, the concept of fair balance isn't entirely settled, it seems to me. As drawn in from Strasbourg and in the early Court of Justice case law, it implies a degree of discretion for the decision maker. But that, it seems to be largely lost from the Court of Justice's jurisprudence and domestic jurisprudence. What is the relationship between fair balance and proportionality? I mean, fair balance is a sort of proportionality assessment, but in the tobacco plain packaging judicial review in this jurisdiction recently, there were parallel challenges. So the legislation was challenged both on the basis that it was disproportionate, but also separately on the basis that it violated the fundamental property rights of the tobacco companies. And no fair balance assessment was conducted there at all. Health was mentioned, but not in a balancing sense. So in a sense, the jurisprudence seems not to have settled out completely in this area. And there's more that I could say about that, but maybe not now. But essentially, the two fundamental issues, there are two fundamental categories of problem, it seems to me. And one is that the model isn't adopted consistently. And the other problem is the opposite, which was that if you do adopt it consistently, then some strange consequences might follow. The evidence for suggesting that this model hasn't been adopted entirely consistently seems to me to be obvious. So we see a reference to GS Media, in GS Media, to fair balance as the overall framework, but then no mention at all in Svensson that this balance of rights has anything to do with a question raised. That might just be about time. You know, the charter has become more deeply embedded as we get to GS Media, so it's bound to be referenced more frequently. And actually, I've heard Judge Malinowski extrajudicially explaining Svensson as being charter-based. He doesn't say that in the judgment, but he says that any other conclusion in Svensson would have violated the right of freedom of expression under the charter. But also in other contexts, so the Luxan judgment, where a state's granting of a right to a producer rather than a film director was held to be a violation of Article 17, an expropriation. That's a clearly important part of that case. In subsequent cases of Reprobel and Soulier, which cover very, very similar situations, they're about the attribution of rights to a particular owner within a framework, which the court finds to be unreasonable and lawful, no mention at all of Article 17 or expropriation. Finally, the recent case about e-lending, the VOB case, whether or not e-lending could come within the derogations and indeed within the concept of lending, a case which seems to me to be completely open to a fair balance analysis. There are lots of rights in the charter that could have been affected there. Well, no mention at all. So inconsistent use. Also, what about consistency with other interpretive principles? Court often mentions the need to narrowly interpret exceptions with a three-step test and also refers to purposive interpretations at a number of points. How do those tie in with the concept of fair balance? We can probably render them consistent in some way or other, but not perhaps the idea of narrow interpretations of exceptions. That just seems inconsistent with the concept of a need to balance up the conflicting interests. So, you know, there's an issue there that will need to be resolved. There's also a lack of detailed reference to the fundamental rights form, particularly to the law of the European Court of Human Rights, when the court talks about the fair balance. I mean, that's apparent in McFadden. McFadden is a case about the apparent conflict between the property interests of the IP holders, Sony particularly, the music copyright holder, and the right to conduct a business of the person with an open wireless network. Basically, that is decided within a fair balance framework. What the court does in the end, though, is to say there are three options here. One is, we prohibit you having a network at all. Two, we allow you to have it as open as you like. Or thirdly, we say it ought to be password protected. And, unsurprisingly, the third option is the one that's adopted. Now, simply the application of a compromise formula or a reasonableness or a fairness test would work there. In a sense, the idea of fair balance between fundamental rights is unnecessarily potent to deliver an outcome, and one can doubt its real impact upon the outcome in the particular situation. And this sort of failure to take fully into account the nature of rights as protected within the human rights system is something that's been particularly criticised by a number of people that I've listed there, and Martin was one of them, in relation to the property right. You know, this is often not viewed as an inherently qualified right when it's put into the balance. It's put into the balance as an apparent absolute. So if we think of the two things going into either pan as spheres, in a sense, the interest in property, for all of the reasons that Martin's explained, ought in a sense to have a chunk bitten out of it, really. Because it's not an absolute entitlement to property, it's an entitlement to property as defined in the legal system and as subject to its social function as well. So there are issues there. What happens if we do what I am suggesting should happen, which I'm half suggesting should happen, which is that this exercise is a little bit fraudulent, or it's a little bit loose, and we ought to be a little bit more consistent about it. Well, we might get some problems then, it seems to me, as well, really, because we will see a diminution in the significance of the secondary legislation. So the Charter has primary status. It's more important than the directives within a legal hierarchy. So, for example, if we were to decide that a particular parody was protected by the right of freedom of expression in applying a balance test, then that's not something that just should be permitted, that's something that must be allowed to happen. So even if a national law has no parody exception, you know, that used to be us, now I suspect it's Ireland, I don't know anybody else, but that national scheme is no longer accurate because it must be protected. And if it must be allowed to happen, then that means, for example, that Article 5 of the Information Society Directive, which is described as a list of options, isn't in fact a list of options at all. It's a list of options plus some obligations. A related but flip side point is the one that Martin mentioned previously, which is a risk of petrification. So if we decide that you have to password protect your wireless network because Article 16 requires that must happen, then that ought to mean that if the legislature decides we don't think that's a great idea and we think that people should be able to have open access wireless networks, then the legislature can't actually do anything about that because it's been determined at this superior level. That seems to me to be potentially problematic. Martin appropriately described it as petrification. Thomas Mullier has described it as a lock-in. And the final point, and this is pretty much my final point, if we're saying that fair balance is a sort of organising principle in this context, then we have to be sure that it's capable of capturing all relevant interests. We've seen that it captures users' interests in speech, it captures the property interests of right holders, the right to conduct a business of people involved in IP transactions. And we've also seen that the analysis a court conducts is not always bipolar. We've seen that three sets of interests can be put on the scales. We've seen in this country, you know, mechanisms developed for ensuring that those interests are developed. But there also seem to me principles that we might want to use to develop our copyright law that would be harder to accommodate in a fair balance idea. So if we think of the state, so we think of transformativeness, which has had an impact on fair use case law deriving from the US Constitution, I mean, that's based upon the idea that the law should promote further creativity. Could we fit that under the heading of one of the rights? I mean, maybe we could. There are so many of them, and they're so broadly defined, that we might say that the right of information of undisclosed users, in a sense, would be served by more works in future. But what about economic efficiency? If we want to govern our law in accordance with economic efficiency, then it's hard to see how that would fit within this framework. So, in conclusion, this, as you will have appreciated, is work, is thought in, definitely in progress. It's hard to know in the jurisprudence of the court whether fair balance is a sort of background value, which we all respect, whether it's a really useful tool in certain circumstances, like pro musici, like Detmin, for example, or whether it's more of a consistent organising principle. If it isn't the latter, is ad hoc reference to constitutional rights in case law, in some cases not in other, and I know it depends on what question is asked and so on, and that's significant, is that acceptable when you're dealing with a constitutional framework? I mean, in the past, I would have suggested, the outrage about that, and have argued very strongly that it wasn't acceptable. I'm not so sure now, but I do think it is at least mildly problematic. So, yeah. Thank you.